dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201 CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last Tuesday, the trial of the St. Patrick's Day 4 in Ithaca, New York, ended with a jury deadlocked 9-3 in favor of acquittal of the four Ithaca Catholic workers who were defending themselves against felony charges of criminal mischief in the third degree that stemmed from their blood-pouring action at a military recruiting center 3 days before the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. Judge John Sherman declared a mistrial following the second communication from the jury announcing that they could not reach a unanimous verdict after 2 days of deliberation. At issue was not whether the defendants had poured blood at the military recruiting center. Daniel Burns, Peter DeMott, Claire Grady, and Teresa Grady all testified under oath that they had. At issue was whether they had a reasonable belief that they had a right to do so. The defendants asserted that they believed they had an obligation under international law to take action to impede an impending illegal war, while the prosecution argued for a narrow interpretation of property rights. I'm going to play you two clips that highlight these two views. First, the closing argument for the defense given by defendant Daniel Burns.
I would now like to remind you of the promise you made to us in the jury selection. You promised to do justice in this case. For hundreds of years, our society has relied on the wisdom and courage of 12 ordinary people, jurors, to do justice. I know you will keep your promise and do justice, to be the conscience of the community now that the case is finally in your hands. The prosecution will try to make you look at this case through a very narrow lens and tell you that you have no choice but to convict us. But that is clearly not the case. The prosecution has given you a lot of facts, but not the truth of the matter. The jury's role is to apply the law to the facts and to produce justice. We know we will look at the whole picture and seek justice. The prosecutor has charged us with the crime of criminal mischief. The judge will tell you that the prosecutor must prove three elements. We intended to damage the property of another. Two, we had no right nor any reasonable ground to believe we had a right to do so. And three, the damage exceeded $250. Again, the prosecution wants you to look at this very narrowly and technically. We want you to use your common sense and look at these elements in the context of the real world. What is the context of our action? The immediate context. For the justice of our action is the preemptive war against Iraq. The invasion of Iraq was opposed by the United Nations, opposed by most nations in the world, and founded on lies about weapons of mass destruction. It is an invasion that has cost $1 billion a day, over 650 American sons and daughters, and 10,000 of our Iraqi sisters and brothers. We also ask you to look at the justice of our action in the light of the context of international law. Why was the invasion opposed by the UN and many of our allies? Because international law only allows an attack on another country in self-defense or with approval of the UN Security Council. And we had neither. And the Nuremberg Principles provide a legal defense and a moral imperative for people seeking to prevent war crimes and crimes against the peace. We also ask you to look at the justice of our action in a religious context. Think of thou shalt not kill. Love your enemies. And Jesus in the temple, where he disturbed the peace to protest the injustices of the temple. The historical context is also important to judge the justice of our action. Remember the Boston Tea Party, Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King, Gandhi, Susan B. Anthony, Sojourner Truth. The prosecution will tell you to forget all that, but we say justice demands that you use common sense and context. So in these contexts, how does justice apply to the elements of the charge? The first element, damage to property. We ask you to balance the mess we made with the horrors we were trying to prevent. If you do, you will find justice. The second element is the right to do so, or reasonable ground to believe we had such a right. We have tried to explain our religious, historical, moral, and international law reasons. We believe what most other people in the world believe, that no country has a right to invade and bomb another country except in self-defense. We think history will judge that this was an illegal and immoral war, that is what we tried to stop. Even though we are not lawyers, I hope we are able to explain our reasons to you so that you may apply justice. The third element is damage of over $250. We hurt no person. We admitted from the beginning that we poured our blood, prayed, and stayed to take responsibility for our actions, because what we did was right. The prosecution has not given you proof beyond a reasonable doubt that you can put any cost on the mess we created. Mr. Preston admitted on the stand that he gave one bill under oath to the grand jury and a completely different one under oath here in this court. That alone is enough to create reasonable doubt about the proof of the damages. Mr. Preston also testified that he did no cleaning himself. Two people did most of the day's work and he paid them $7 to $10 an hour. 14 hours at 10 an hour is far, far less than 250. And we all know the cost of ammonia. He wanted to be paid $45 an hour, and who blames him? But use your common sense and consider what the real cost is. The prosecution has not proven this element. No jury would convict four people of breaking and entering if they broke into a burning house to try to save a child. Here, the building was on fire, as Iraq is now. And we went in to try to save our troops and innocent Iraqis. We did not save them, but justice says we should not be punished for trying. So we end where we started. We ask for justice. We ask for justice for the people of Iraq. We ask for justice for our troops. We ask for justice to say no to preemptive illegal war. We ask for justice for the poor in America. We ask for justice for world peace. Send a message to the world from Tompkins County. We say yes to conscience. We say yes to love thy neighbor. We say yes to international law, and we say yes to justice. Thank you.
That was Daniel Burns giving his closing statement at trial last Monday in Tompkins County Court. The next clip is Prosecutor Deputy DA Jennifer Worrell.
The defendant's guilt is as apparent as their blood on the American flag. The defendants have admitted doing the acts which constitute the crime, but they claim they somehow did not have the requisite intent required by the statute, and that simply is not so. In discussing the defendant's guilt, I would like to briefly go through the facts as I believe the evidence has shown them to be, and then discuss how the facts prove the elements of the crime. I'm not going to spend much time on the facts, as there really isn't much dispute as to the facts. A week or so prior to March 17, 2003, all four defendants met and decided to pour their blood inside the recruiting station. They got together somewhere and, with the help of someone, withdrew blood from defendants Burns and DeMott's. They then stored their blood in the containers marked with their names. On March 17, 2003, at approximately 4 p.m., they went to the recruiting station and they poured their blood throughout the recruiting station. Sergeant Montgomery and Sergeant Marine were in the office. They heard the door open and they went out to see if anyone was in the building. As Sergeant Montgomery exited and went into the lobby, he saw the defendants there pouring their blood throughout the lobby. He asked them to stop and to leave, but they refused. He then went back, he told Sergeant Marine what was going on outside. As he was doing so, defendants Teresa and Claire Grady went outside and poured the blood on the sidewalk outside. Sergeant Marine then came back out into the lobby. He saw what was going on, and he, too, asked them to leave and to stop, and they refused. Sergeant Marine then went back and called the police. Sergeant Montgomery locked the front door, and as he was doing so, Daniel Burns was still pouring blood around. He poured some on the door, and it landed on Sergeant Montgomery's hand. The police arrived shortly thereafter, and Deputy Baker came in, spoke with Daniel Burns, asked him what the red substance was. Daniel Burns told him it was blood, human blood, and it came out of my vein. All four defendants were then arrested. Teresa and Claire Grady were asked to stand so they could be walked outside of the building. They refused to do so and had to be carried out by the officers. Those are the facts as I believe the evidence has shown them to be, and now I will talk about the elements of the crime. The defendants have been charged with criminal mischief in the third degree. By such charge, the people have alleged, and we have now proven, three things. One, the defendants intended to damage property of another. Two, they had no right to do so, nor any reasonable ground to believe they had such right. And three, the damages exceeded $250. I would first like to talk about the damages. The judge will instruct you that damage is the cost to replace or repair the damaged property, whichever is less. And that includes cleaning costs. Now, our burden is just to prove that the damages are more than $250. We don't have to prove the exact dollar amount. And we have certainly proven the damages exceeded $250. The cleaning bill itself was $958. Now, the defendants want to argue that that bill is somehow inflated. Well, you can look at the bills when you're back there deliberating, and you can see that the first bill was for one amount, and the second bill was for a lesser amount. The only difference between the two is one person, that extra third person that Richard Preston thought was cleaning and later found out was not. And it's that 7 hours times $45, that's the difference between the two bills. New Plan Realty, the owners of the building, asked Richard Preston to clean a room full of blood. It's not his regular line of business to clean up blood, but he does do work for them, so he agreed to do so. And he charged them what he normally charges to clean the outside of the building, spring cleaning, and also to do the plowing. He explained to you the difference between the two bills, that he thought one of the people that were doing spring cleaning helped with the building, and when he found out they didn't, he sent an amended bill to New Plan Realty. New Plan Realty has paid that bill. You know Richard Preston and his company, Preston's, cleaned the building because the two sergeants told you there were two people there the next day doing cleaning. And they told you they were there all day and the extensive amount of cleaning that they did. They told you the man was up on a stepladder scrubbing and cleaning the walls. He would scrub them. It just sort of smeared the blood. Then he'd scrub it again. It would get a little bit lighter. He would scrub it again. It would get a little bit lighter. He told you the walls were cleaned at least three times. And he told you the woman was on her hands and knees scrubbing the blood off the floor. She would scrub it and then mop it and scrub it and then mop it. They also clean the windows and the banners. The defendants argue $45 is too much to charge. Again, we disagree, especially considering the work that was done. And remember that $45 an hour includes Preston's overhead, his insurance, and his profit. He's not going to do this just out of the goodness of his heart. He does have a business to run. If you think $45 is too much, you can knock it down to $20 an hour for each worker. Times 14 hours, that still gets you over $250. And that's not even including Richard Preston's time, the cost of the flag, or the cleaning supplies to clean up the building. Now, when you're deliberating and thinking about how much it cost, look at the photos. Look at the extensive damage that was done here. They didn't just go in and pour the blood in a nice little puddle in the middle of the floor. They poured it everywhere, all over. And blood is messy. It gets into crevices. It gets into the baseboards. They had to scrub those. It's difficult to clean. You know, the defendants created the situation, and now they want to complain about it. They didn't give New Plan Realty or Sergeant Marine or Montgomery any advance notice that they were coming. They didn't call up and say, hey, we're going to come and pour our blood all over your lobby. So why don't you start calling around and, one, find out someone who's willing to clean up human blood, and then find the lowest price possible. This was an emergency. The defendants came at the end of a workday. New Plan Realty didn't call up somebody and make them work throughout the night and charge double, triple overtime. But they did have to find somebody quickly. So they called up Preston's, and Preston's agreed to do it, and the amount charged was reasonable. When the defendants went into the station, they all knew every one of them would be pouring the blood around the station. They were acting in concert. The judge will give you the definition on acting in concert, but they all worked together, they planned this, and they're all responsible for the total amount of damages. We are not required to say, oh, this defendant only poured it here, this defendant only poured it here. We're not required to split up the costs like that. They're all responsible for the total damages. I would now like to talk about the defendant's intent. These four defendants intended to damage the property of another. That was their conscious objective. In other words, this was no mistake. Property of another, that pretty much is self-explanatory, and the judge will instruct you on that definition. But basically, New Plan Realty owns the building, the United States government leases it. The defendants are not the owners of the building or any of the items inside the building. Their argument that the fact that the government leases this building somehow makes it theirs is absurd. If that were the case, no government property would ever be protected because every citizen could say, oh, that's partly mine, I can do whatever I want to it. Now, we know the defendants intended to damage the building and the items inside because of what they did. They told you they went in there with the intention of pouring their blood. Therefore, they intended to damage the property. You cannot separate the two. You cannot say, I only intended to do the act, but not the logical consequence. They go hand in hand. This is human blood. It's not water. It's messy. It's smelly. It's unsanitary. And you can't expect it not to cause damage. You can't expect it not to be cleaned. And for Mr. DeMont to tell you otherwise, that he thought maybe the blood could stay there, is unreasonable. People will not and should not work under those circumstances. If you plan on doing something like this, you should plan on paying for the damages, and you should expect the damages to be costly because the cleanup process is time-consuming and it's unpleasant. So when these four defendants decided to use human blood, they knew they would damage the property. They all told you so. They told you they knew it would have to be cleaned, but they made that conscious choice to do it. That was their intent. Now, the defendants argue their intent was just to bring attention to the impending war and to alert the recruits of the dangers of the war. Well, that argument falls short. First of all, you can have more than one intent. The defendants told you so themselves. Secondly, bringing attention to this war wasn't really their intent, it was their motive. It is why they did what they did. Their intent was to pour the blood on the property. That was the means to their end. That was how they intended on achieving their goal of bringing attention to this war. And they thought that was the best way they could go about doing that. And I'd like you to remember that we do not have to prove the defendants intended to damage property over $250, just that they intended to damage the property, and that the damages were in excess of $250. So now I'd like to talk about the last element, basically the part of their defense, that They had no right to damage property, nor any reasonable ground to believe they had such right. Well, we all know the defendants had no right to damage the property because, one, it wasn't theirs, and two, they did not have the permission from the owner to damage the property. Again, the building belongs to New Plan. The flag belonged to a sergeant in the Army. The defendants could have legally poured blood on their house or on their flag, but they chose not to do so. And again, their argument that they somehow had a right to damage this property because it belongs to the government is not reasonable. Think of all the buildings that could be damaged if you follow that line of logic. And we know they didn't have the permission from the owner. They didn't call up anybody from New Plan. They didn't call up anybody who works at the recruiting station. They didn't call and say, we're going to do this, can we have your permission? And we know why they didn't do that, because nobody would ever give them permission to do so. Nobody is ever going to say, that's a great idea, come damage our property, come ruin our property to make your point. It is not reasonable for them to think they could do that. Did the defendants have a reasonable ground to believe they had a right to damage property? The answer is simply no. What is a reasonable ground to believe you have the right to damage property of another? I would submit, and common sense would tell you, it's one of two things. One, you think it's your property, but it isn't. Or two, you thought you had permission from the owner, but you don't. You have a tree that's borderline your property and the next property, and you think it's your tree, you think it's about to fall onto your house, and you look at the deed and you're like, yeah, I think that's on my property, I'm gonna go cut it down. You find out later, no, it wasn't your tree. It really was your neighbor's. Well, you did damage the tree, but you had a reasonable ground to believe that you thought that was your tree. Or you think you have the permission from the owner. You paint cars for a living, and someone comes in and says, I want you to paint my black Honda pink. You go outside, there's two black Hondas, you paint the wrong one. There, you thought you had the right to paint the car, but you really, from the owner, but you really didn't. That would be a reasonable ground to believe you had right to damage somebody's property. Neither is the situation here. The defendants instead argue they had a reasonable ground to believe they had a right to damage property based upon law. They somehow believed international law gave them this right. Well, the judge will instruct you, however, that international law, including the Nuremberg principles, do not apply. So then we need to look to see if their belief was reasonable, and it simply was not. It is not reasonable to think that you can violate a state law to avoid liability under international law, even if you sincerely believe your government is engaged in illegal conduct. Now, for a belief to be reasonable, the defendants actually have had to have believed it, and a reasonable person, knowing what they knew, would also have to believe that. Now, I'm not going to stand here and tell you that the defendants' beliefs aren't sincere. You can even admire the strength of their convictions and the fact that they're willing to do more than just talk, but you cannot admire what they did that day. You cannot condone it. If you want to admire the way anyone acted that day, admire the way that Sergeant Montgomery and Sergeant Marine acted that day. They simply went to work and had people come in and throw blood around their place of employment, but yet they handled it professionally. Admire the way the police acted that day. They responded to this call and treated the defendants with courtesy. Yes, we are lucky enough to live in a country where everyone is free to have their own opinion. And the defendants were certainly entitled to their belief that the impending war was illegal and they had to do something to try and stop it, but they had to do so in a legal way. Unlike your beliefs, which can be limitless, there are limits placed on our actions. That is how our society functions. If there were no limits, we would have anarchy. It is not reasonable to think that because you disagree with your government, no matter how strongly or sincerely, that somehow gives you the right to damage property of another. It is simply not reasonable to have that belief. If that were so, then it would be reasonable to, if you thought taxes were illegal, to throw a brick through the building at the IRS, or to smash all the computers at City Hall if you think a ban on gay marriage is illegal. The possibilities would be endless. Where would you draw the line? You simply couldn't, because you would be leaving it up to individuals to decide, one, if the action that their government taking is illegal, and two, what they should do about it. Now, the defendants also claim they were legally or morally justified in doing this, and that their beliefs about the horror of war somehow should excuse their behavior. Well, the judge will instruct you on the statute of legal justification, and it simply does not fit here, and it was not reasonable for these defendants to think it did. First of all, this was not an emergency measure. Defendant Burns tells you the building was on fire. We all know what he meant by that, but the building was not on fire. If the building were actually literally on fire, in flames, of course they would have a right to break a window to go in there and save lives. There would be no question about that. But the danger, and it was a horrific danger, the danger of losing lives in Iraq, was not imminent. It was not happening at that moment. This was not an emergency response to that. It was millions of miles away, and it was not reasonable to think that the actions that they did that day would actually have any effect on the impending war. They were simply not going to stop the war by pouring blood on one recruiting station in Lansing, New York. It's not reasonable for them to think that that would change, have any effect on the war. The defendants also had legal alternatives. In order to use this statute, to fall under this statute, you have to have no legal alternatives available to you. And that simply is not the case. The defendants could have stood outside the recruiting station, and they could have brought their own flag. They could have poured their own blood on their own flag, and that would have been fine. But they chose not to do so. Furthermore, a reasonable person, knowing what the defendants knew, would have done some further research. They would have done some checking out to see if what they were about to do, if they really were somehow legally justified in doing that. They would have called up the district attorney's office. They would have called up the police. They would have called up and said, this is what we think. This is what we believe. Is it really right? Can we really do this? Is this what the statute really means? The defendants didn't do any of this. And we know why. Because they knew what the answer would be, and they were going to do what they were going to do anyways. The defendants' actions were also unreasonable in light of the fact that they were at the same recruiting station. Peter DeMott told you he was at the same recruiting station in December of 2002, 3 months prior to this time, and that he was arrested at that time, again, for refusing to leave. Was it reasonable for him to go back 3 months later, do the same thing, refuse to leave, and damage property, and think he had a right to do so? No, it is not reasonable. Defendants' beliefs are not only unreasonable, they seem to be a bit arrogant, that they know more than the recruits themselves. They know what is going on inside the recruits' heads. They know that when these recruits are going in there, that they don't know anything about the horrors of war, that somehow these recruits don't know that they could die or that they could be asked to kill somebody. They don't know about all the dangers of the war. They also think they know more than the government. They know everything there is to know about this impending war at that time. And that somehow their religious beliefs and their personal experiences give them a special right. That they somehow feel more sympathy for the troops in Iraq than the rest of us. And that their beliefs and their rights trump those of Sergeant Marin and Sergeant Montgomery's to go to work that day. That their beliefs somehow are more important than the sergeant's rights to be at work and not have blood poured all around their workplace. When it is all said and done, ladies and gentlemen, what we really have here are defendants with sincere but unreasonable beliefs. Defendants who have repeatedly asked you to ignore the law and to find them guilty because of those beliefs. because they were sincere, because they feel that what they were doing was for a good cause. But that is not what the law allows, and I am asking you to uphold the law and to find the defendants guilty as charged. Thank you.
Tompkins County Prosecutor Jennifer Worrell giving her closing argument in the St. Patrick's Day 4 trial last Monday in Ithaca. Presiding Judge John Sherman ruled prior to the trial that defendants would not be allowed to have expert witnesses testify to international law or necessity as a defense, though he did allow them to speak about their understandings of international law that had motivated their actions. Damasio Lopez is the executive director of the International Depleted Uranium Study Team, IDUST. He was one of the witnesses barred from testifying. We spoke with him about the problem of depleted uranium at home and abroad. He began by explaining how we first became involved in the issue 2 decades ago.
My name is Damasio Lopez, and I'm the executive director of the International Depleted Uranium Study Team, which is made up of scientists, attorneys, veterans, activists, soldiers, and just plain people throughout the world in many, many different places. I got involved in this by accident. I used to be a professional golfer, and in late 1985, I had an automobile accident while I was headed to the Phoenix Open for a qualifying round to play there. Hurt my back quite badly, and so I went back to Socorro, New Mexico, which was my hometown. I had not been there for several years. And while there in Socorro, I would hear these tremendous booms right next to our home on the Socorro Mountain. And I started asking my parents what was going on, and they said that they had been hearing these booms for a very long time. They asked me if I would look into it and see if there was, find out what was going on, and what if there was big clouds of black smoke that would go up into the air every time one of these explosions went off, and the prevailing winds would bring these black clouds right over the community, my house, and brothers and mother and relatives border the fence to this facility they call TERRA, Terminal Effects Research and Analysis Group, at a school called New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology. This is how it all got started. My parents asked me to check into it and find out just what was going on there, because they had some cracks on their walls, a window had broken, chandelier had fallen down. They were concerned about the booms more than anything else.
And this was what year?
This was right at the very beginning of 1985, January 1985.
So that was 19 years ago. Okay, then what happened when we tried to look into that matter?
I asked the president of the university to be put on the agenda for the Board of Regents meeting and the upcoming one, and I did. I went to his Board of Regents meeting, and I asked them what exactly were they doing on this mountain, and what their intentions were, and what was in that black cloud of smoke that went up each time those explosions would go off. They told me that there was it was just conventional weapons. It was nothing to worry about, and that it was not a problem, and couldn't understand why anyone would even speak up, because they said they had been doing it for a very long time. And so I was quite happy about that. Conventional weapons to me means that they're using explosives or something that's not gonna hurt people. At least I'm thinking, you know, dynamite isn't going to be that big a problem. So I went back to my parents, my mom and dad, and told them that there was nothing to worry about. Everything was fine. I was recuperating from an automobile accident, as I said, and the time had come. It was time for me to go back to work. And my back was starting to feel better, and I was glad that things were working out so well there at in Socorro, and that there was not a problem. It was a non-problem. There was a newspaper reporter there at this Board of Regents meeting, and she went ahead and did a story in the newspaper saying that I was asking questions about the testing of these weapons. The time was coming for me to go back to my work as a professional golfer. And one morning, about a week before I was getting ready to go back to Arizona, I was a golf pro in Yuma, Arizona, I saw in the morning when I got up a pile of boxes in front of my house, my front door. I thought somebody's brought their garbage here. And I opened one of the boxes, and lo and behold, these boxes must have weighed close to a ton. There was many boxes, had documents, many documents, dated back some 30, 40 years to the present. And in these boxes, I found these documents that clearly stated that what had been tested there by this facility was depleted uranium in weapons. And the more I looked at the documents, I saw that it was not just the school that was testing them. There was private contractors there, the Army, the Navy, many different departments within the government were involved in this whole thing and had been involved for a long time. And this was in, as I said, 1986. And it also indicated clearly, and that indicated it was clear in the documents, that they had been testing these weapons there in Socorro since 1973, unbeknownst to the Socorro community. And when I saw this and realized that it was the Pentagon, it was the U.S. government, and then I saw that there was other countries involved that were also doing some testing there as well and collaborating, and many different corporations that are defense contractors. I had been a golf pro for 17 years, and in those 17 years, I played with generals, I played with the CEOs of some of these very companies that were there, and high-ranking people in these companies. And I knew the kind of power they had. I was very disturbed. I was disturbed because of what had been taking place, and I was also disturbed because I was just one little person in this little town of 7,000 people, and here was something taking place where radioactive waste was being used in weaponry, and those black clouds of smoke, it was clear to me from the information in the boxes that it was uranium that was going up into the air in those black clouds of smoke. I thought to myself, well, I think I'll just leave this alone. This is way beyond me. I can't do anything about this. And I felt a bit cowardly about it. A few days went by, and right before I was getting ready to go back to Arizona, I thought to myself, you ought to do something. You can't just walk away. Why don't you go there and talk to this president of school and at least tell him what you found out and see how he reacts. And then be on your way, maybe clear my conscience a little bit that I could at least speak up. So I walked into his office, the president of the school, and I said, you know, you and the Board of Regents, armed with some of the key information that I had taken out of the boxes. I said, you and the Board of Regents have told me and the community that there's no need to worry, these are conventional weapons. I have documents here that clearly indicate that what has been tested here since 1973 in these weapons is depleted uranium. President of the school became very quiet. His face changed in color. His expression changed. He seemed to be off guard. And he thought for, seemed like 30 seconds or almost a minute. And then he said, he got his composure and he looked at me and he said, what's the matter with you, boy? Don't you understand English? It's depleted of uranium. And I knew a little bit more about depleted uranium now that I had read these documents, and it was clear to me when I read the documents that depleted uranium is actually pure uranium. It just has one of the isotopes partially removed that's taken off to make nuclear weapons, and the rest of it is called depleted uranium, but it's pure uranium.
Radioactive.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And a prohibited item. You can't just release this out into the environment. It's against the law to do such things, not only in the United States, but many countries throughout the world, most countries, at least countries that have nuclear activity. I didn't know quite how to respond, and I didn't say nothing. I was just surprised at how aggressive he had gotten towards me. And I stood there, and he said, his final comment was to me was, "You know, boy, you ought to go to school and learn English." I just said nothing. I was totally shocked at the way he had spoke to me. Got on my bicycle and started riding my bike back to my house, and on my way to my house...
How old were you, by the way, at this time?
I'm 60 years old right now, and that was 19 years ago.
Okay, so you're not a boy.
And I'm not a boy. I'm 41 years old at the time. Okay. And on my way home on the bicycle, I said to myself, "Demasio, for once in your life, why don't you just stand up for what's right?" I knew the opposition was huge, and because as I said, I knew people like this. I play golf with them. They would play as my pro-am partners in golf tournaments. So I thought about it on the way home, and I made a conscious decision as I was riding home on my bike that I was not going to walk away from this, and I was not going back into professional golf, that I was going to go ahead and take those documents, and I was going to distribute them. I was going to do whatever I could to stop the use of this stuff next to my house. I made a conscious decision to do it, and I realized at the time that I was going up against the nuclear lobby, the lobby from the defense industry, and the lobby from the United States government. It was well aware of that. Probably the three biggest lobbies in the world. But I decided at that point that I was going to do it. Made that decision.
So then what happened?
Started writing articles. I remember going home even that day, and I took some of the documents, and I wrote this article, a fairly 2 or 3 page article, and I sent it to some 40 different newspapers across the United States. I was kind of surprised that so many of them published it, and I was getting a lot of calls, and people wanted to know more about it. And then I addressed the community and told them what was going on, and I went to the local newspaper and exposed whatever information I could and released it, and I had a lot of information. Much more information than I could understand. I was not a nuclear physicist or a chemist or a medical scientist, but nevertheless, I saw enough there to understand that what was being used here was radioactive waste and weaponry, and that black cloud of smoke that was coming over the community was probably, most likely, raining radioactive dust on the people of the community. So I wrote these articles, and later on we put together a group there, or I did, called Save Our Mountain. Brought together some community people, and it was a big discussion that took place, and it was very interesting to see how the community responded. They were demanding why it was that since 1973 to 1986, they had been secretly testing uranium weapons right next to the community without the people knowing what was going on. And the people felt that maybe they were being endangered. About this same time, the state legislature was in the process of passing legislation there so to give money to the school to buy more property around the facility that was already 6,000 acres in a little mountain there called the Socorro Mountain. And by the way, that's where the Socorro community gets their drinking water from the wells below that mountain. So they were meeting in Santa Fe to get another 8,000 acres around the existing 9,000 or 6,000 acres that was already there. So I went to the state legislature to tell them what I knew and to oppose what was going on. And while at the state legislature, the night that it was time to give testimony, I was waiting outside the conference room, and so was the president of the school, New Mexico Tech, the person that I had told me that, you know, I needed to learn English. And he invited me to have a cup of coffee with him. Sounded a little strange, but I thought, well, why not? Just see what he's up to. So we went over to the coffee machine. He whipped out a couple of cups and handed me a cup of coffee. And And then he looked at me and he said, you know, Damasio, if you go in there and testify, you're going to be found dead along some ditch.
What was the name of the president of the school?
Dr. Lawrence Lapman. There was no witnesses, just me and him. I was shocked, totally shocked. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I walked away from him, went back to the door, and about this time they were ready for us. I went in, he went in, he gave his testimony, I gave my testimony. The Appropriations Committee, only one person voted against giving this money to the school. All the rest of the legislators voted for it, and I found that quite interesting as well. And when the committee meeting was over, the president of the school walked up to me and he said, boy, he said, you did real good there. Very sarcastic, looked very angry because of what I had told the state, legislators. I went back to Socorro the next day, and I contacted some friends, some attorney friends, and told them what had happened, and they told me that I better be very careful in the future about where I was and what I did, and to not be alone, particularly at night. So I tried to follow that advice. But on March 1st, this is when it was, I was starting to get dark, and I was in town. I was at a pub with some friends having a beer, and it started to get dark outside, so I thought I better get going. So I got on my bike. I had had maybe 2 beers, maybe 3. And so I got on my bicycle, and I'm headed back to the house, and I was going, trying to hurry and get home before it got dark, thinking about what the attorneys had told me. About one half of a block from my home, it started to get dark. I don't know what happened. I didn't see anybody, but all of a sudden, everything turned red. This was about 7 o'clock in the evening. Somewhere around 1 in the morning, learned later, I found myself opening my eyes in a hospital room at the local hospital. I tried to lift my arm and I could not. I tried to turn my head and I could not. My eyes would barely open. One of my arms I was able to reach up, and I felt my head. My head was huge, and I had dried blood throughout my head and face. I was in terrible pain. What had happened was this nurse, friend of the family's, had driven by on her way home from the hospital that night about 1 in the morning and saw the bicycle next to the ditch near my home and found my body laying there in a pool of coagulated blood. And my face and body was cold. She checked for a pulse, she told me later, and for breath, and could get none. So she went to my house, 1 o'clock in the morning, to my parents, and told them to call an ambulance, that I was laying alongside the ditch, and that she had not been able to find any life in my body. She had checked, and that had no pulse and wasn't breathing. And as I said, I woke up around 1 o'clock in the morning, and I was in excruciating pain. Later on, the injuries that I had was I had a huge gash to the side of my head, right side, other bumps around my head and cuts. My collarbone was sticking up, broken, dislocated. Bruises, multiple bruises on my legs. I had some 3 or 4 cracked ribs, a lot of bruises. Some people I thought must have done something terrible to me, because there was no way that falling off this bicycle could I get all these multiple wounds and injuries. Some of my friends went back to the place where I went with them. My mother took me out of the hospital and took me to Albuquerque, to the VA hospital. But before I did that, some of my friends went to that place where they found my body, and it was quite obvious that my bicycle had been moved next to the ditch. The reason I felt that was because I was going down the road, and there was the curve was this way, which I would have gone to the left of the road, but my bicycle was on the right-hand side of the road where the ditch was. And also what I found there was where my blood was, where it had come down, where my body had come down on the road. There was blood there. And it wasn't just blood sitting up. It was like something had been, like my body had been drug over this blood. There was a lot of it, and had been drug across the road. This is what I surmised. And there was a bottle of whiskey sitting in the area where I saw the pool of blood next to the ditch. It was about half empty and it was open. I got a hold of the police to ask them if they had investigated this, and they said yes, they had investigated it. I asked them if they knew what had happened, and they said nothing. I'm assuming they didn't. There was an article in the newspaper that I had been found alongside it. The title of the article was Accident or Foul Play. The policeman told the reporter that they smelled liquor, a lot of liquor, heavy odor of liquor on me when they found me, and that I must have fallen off of my bike. That was the response, and that's what came out in the newspaper.
So, did you believe that the police to be implicated in this?
At the time, I had no idea what to think. My head was like a basketball. I was getting these terrible, like, explosions inside my head. I don't know if other people have this when they suffer trauma to the head or not, but I was in a lot of pain, very mixed up. It was hard to make sense of things. My memory was very spotty. It was difficult for me to even think. I was hurt very badly. Had amnesia after that. Not, you know, first it was quite spotty. Sometimes I would be somewhere and I'd be speaking to somebody, and all of a sudden I would stop and not know what I was saying, or what I had just said, or even where I was. And this went on for about 3 years. I had a lot of problems, and I was very scared. Of course, I thought about what the president of the school had said to me.
By the coffee machine.
The coffee machine, yeah, and to me, the connection between those two was quite strong. And as I said, I became quite scared, and I isolated myself, not only from the community, but from my own family. My own family, my mother told me that I should stop doing what I was doing, that this was causing problems for everybody, particularly myself, and that I should stop my activities against this facility. People in the community made the connection. Usually people like myself, brown people, don't speak up in that community. And when I did...
Tell me about the race and class composition of Socorro. Well, just a little bit.
Socorro is a town that originally, when the Spanish came here, was Indians, Native Americans, Pueblo Indians. My ancestry goes back to those people. And the Spanish came, it was a mixture of blood. And then later on, white people started coming in there after New Mexico became a state. The composition of the community is mostly, we say, Hispanic, but you know, most of the people are mixed with Indian blood. And the percentage of white people is not maybe 30-40%.
And are those well-to-do white people or poor white people? Or?
Very few poor white people. Most of them are well-to-do. Most of them are involved in business and things of that nature. Many connected with the school, New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology. A lot of them depend on that school for their business and contracts and so forth. And the Hispanic community does as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So basically all of these people, brown and white, well-to-do and poor, everyone is having these black clouds come over their heads.
The entire community.
Okay, but obviously you did go back to your work. How did that happen? What kept you at it?
Well, prior to this attack, or prior, we can call it an accident, or we're back to the accident or foul play. Even to this day, I am not quite sure. You asked me if I had any idea who had done this to me or what had happened. Mm-hmm. The only thing I recollect is I don't recollect anything happening, but several weeks after the incident, I had some flashbacks, nightmares. What I saw was legs. I saw nothing above the knees, but I saw blue pants, black socks, shiny shoes.
Given that you certainly believed that you had been attacked, that you were very seriously injured, that you believed that the threat made by the present Lapman at the coffee machine in the state legislature had been realized,
yes.
You were very seriously injured, and for a while you sealed yourself off from everyone and everything.
Yes.
But as I say, so somehow at some point here you are, you're still working on the issue now 19 years later. So
yes.
What happened to you that made you get back into this struggle?
Well, actually, I became isolated. As I said, I isolated myself. And for about 3 years, I kept to myself and actually boarded up some of my windows, and I would lock the door and make sure I had a gun nearby, loaded. I felt that they were going to come back for me. About 2.5 years later, a long time went by. I was quite ill all of that time, and not only ill, but very disappointed on how the community had acted. The organization that I had helped put together had fallen apart. People became very afraid. My own family, as I said.
You're listening to Damasio Lopez, Executive Director of the International Depleted Uranium Study Team, IDUST. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE, Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville.
And one day, somebody comes to my door that I don't know in this white van and starts knocking on the door, and I don't know this man, this white man. And I thought, well, maybe this is it. Maybe this is the person they sent here to finish me off. And I just won't answer the door. But he wouldn't leave. He knocked on the door, and he sat in his van, and he'd come back out and knock on the door. He spent about 3 hours there. Finally, I thought, well, I better face this man.